So when we gather together, it's always an opportunity to come together and reflect on the Dhamma. Here at Santi, we just gather 2 evenings a week, Wednesday and Saturday. So it's nice that tonight coincides more or less with the full moon. The lunar calendar, of course, is something that Buddhist communities everywhere follow and do observances. So there would be Buddhist communities around the globe gathering and meditating around the full moon, contemplating Dharma and practicing. So we can also see ourselves as part of a larger community connected into the larger Sangha. And here at Santi, we've been listening to some of the recent talks that Lumpo Samedo has been giving at Amaravati. Obviously, the phenomenon of the internet makes straddling time and space very easy. So we can listen to teachers giving Dharma talks. We can listen live almost if we want to, if they're streaming live. We usually tune in a couple of days after because we only sit together on our Wednesdays and Saturdays. But it's been nice to connect in to what feels, you know, like a vibrant, present time connection with Sangha. And it's a special for us because Lumpo is an old man now, but he's an old teacher of ours. I first ordained with him and in the Amaravati community in the late 80s. I think Venerable Jayasaro was aware of them and listening to teachings in Australia in the 90s, but also connected at Amaravati in the early 2000s. So Lumpo's teachings run deep in my own practice as a Buddhist, the way, and also I think I was drawn to the teachings of Ajahn Sumedho and Ajahn Chah, the Theravada forest tradition, because there was something that rang very true for me about that expression of truth, in the way that that tradition talked about it. And very central to the articulation of Dharma and reality and the truth to be known in the Theravada forest tradition is this practice of recognizing awareness itself. You don't necessarily get this direct pointing to awareness in all Buddhist traditions. But for me personally, it resonated deeply because I'd already, through my own life up until the point of encountering the Buddha's teaching, for me, awareness, the experience of awareness was already kind of front and center for me in terms of the connection to spiritual reality or spiritual journey. And I couldn't articulate very much about that at the time. But for me, my earlier journey was through my growth in this inquiry, if you like, was very much through the field of art. Had a natural inclination to making art from a young person, from a young age, sorry. And the making of art involves quite a solitary process of observation. When you want to draw something that you see, you have to observe it, you have to spend time with it and look. And reflect on the transference of what you're wanting to express about what you see on that paper, whether in a realistic manner or an abstract manner, there's still a lot of observation and inner reflection, and also not only observing the object you wish to paint, but looking inwards at the process, at the desire to make a mark on the canvas and what you want to say, what you want to express about that. So there's a lot of observation, and I found through that process, naturally as a youngster being drawn to that, but in my later years when I undertook art practice, art training, more consciously recognizing this space of awareness and little insights into what we call, what Buddhism calls reality, or insights into the way things are, would kind of bubble up of themselves. So for me at the time, art was a spiritual domain because it was allowing growth and understanding somehow. And it enlivened or nourished my inner search for truth. I think in my early years it was, and we all experienced this growing up and obviously into our adult years as well, but as a teenager we experience all sorts of emotional upheaval sometimes, and so this experience of the suffering of the emotions in various forms was present, and I was somewhat, it obviously caused me suffering in various ways, but I was quite enthralled at why it did. I was interested in why is there this suffering? What is this emotional turmoil? There must be a way to understand what's going on. And also seeing the suffering in the world around me, whether near in my own family and circle of friends or at a distance through what came in through the media and as one understood the world around us at that time. But anyways, this field of awareness that led me in my early life on a kind of a spiritual journey, a spiritual search. And I guess when I then encountered, having practiced a bit of meditation, being led to Amaravati, and then encountering the forest tradition teachings, really speaking of awareness, as cultivating awareness, that as that wisdom which can penetrate through to the truth of reality is very much connected with this faculty of awareness. Wisdom can grow through seeing the way things are. And the languaging in this tradition, learning to particularly, and that's why I brought up Lungpo Sumedho in the beginning, because from his early years of teaching that I remember him in England, even till now, the main emphasis in his teaching is to trust in awareness. And this is essentially the instruction taking refuge in Buddha. It's not taking refuge in a historical being who's no longer alive. That's not a real refuge, even though we might have faith in the teachings that he has left us and faith in his enlightenment, but a real refuge is ever present here and now. And the seed of Buddhahood is in this inherent awareness that human beings have, in fact that all beings have, but human beings have the capability to reflect on it and to discern what's going on within this field of awareness. So learning to trust in awareness and to observe, to trust in this faculty that allows us to observe what experiences come and go within this field of awareness. Now there's different within the Buddha Dhamma. This may be expressed in many different ways. You might use the words mind or consciousness or awareness or mindfulness or the citta. There are different ways we can talk about this. And different Buddhist traditions will articulate the path of awakening quite differently from each other sometimes, even though it's all rooted in this original Buddhist teaching that comes from Siddhartha Gautama 2,500 years ago. So the other Buddhist tradition that goes directly to awareness and emphasizes awareness from the beginning is the Dzogchen tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, at least that I'm aware of. There may be, I'm not thoroughly familiar with the Zen practices and whether or not they emphasize this, but because I've had particular exposure to these two traditions quite a lot and quite distinct from other ways of Theravada teaching. But I've found it so useful over and over again to keep remembering that this present moment awareness is the ground of awakening, is the ground of reality, is always accessible here and now, no matter what we are experiencing. And this is what a refuge is. Or this is what this refuge can be. It's always accessible here now. And it's always something you can rest in. Whether we find we can or not in any given moment, it's always available. And we practice or we learn, particularly through the meditation experience and mindfulness in our daily life, to keep recognizing this, what I like to term, a field of awareness. We exist within this field of awareness. All of our experiences arise and cease within a field, this field of awareness. Right? It's apparent to recognize that. And it's from this point from which we can observe the experience of this body-mind as it changes, as it manifests, as different experiences arise. So this is the same territory the Buddha is pointing to, where we can come to understand the Dharma being not only that which he teaches, the teaching of liberation, but Dharma also means reality or truth, or this other unusual term it gets translated as, and was talking with Kim and Huang earlier, the way things are. Dharma is often translated as the way things are, reality, or things as they are. And this term can be a little bit boggling for some people, but it's really just meant to be taken straight up. It's things as they are, things as they appear in your experience. When we practice meditation, this is where wisdom or discernment can begin to grow, when we observe what's arising within this field of awareness. When we stop physically moving around and engaging in activity, which is a lot of our waking life, we just stop and sit still for a while and observe what's going on physically and mentally. So even though we stop moving physically, it doesn't mean the body stops inputting data into the mind. The body has a lot to say often when we're just sitting quietly. It kind of tells you all about its various pains and stresses, yeah? And then we're aware also of the momentum of the mind. So these are what the Buddha points to as the khandhas, the aggregates of existence, body and mental formations, memory, thoughts, feeling tones, body as sensation. Body appears, manifests in the mind as sensation. And a play of the elements or elemental experience of earth, water, fire, air, or solidity, hardness, softness, fluidity, wetness, dryness, the thermal qualities, heat and cool, earth, water, fire, air, the various winds, the breath coming in and out, the digestive winds. These are all perceived aspects of physical existence, the form of this body, experienced in the mind in this way. So this is how we frame it, or the Buddha framed it, in terms of inquiring or seeing what's actually there. We have an idea, body, and further is the idea of my body, and further is the image, the perception of how my body looks. Right? And when we're sitting here with our eyes closed, sometimes that image arises, a reflective image of the mind that remembers how my body looks, or sometimes a feeling arises, a tightness in the shoulder, and you can see the thought arise, you know, around that sensation, and you can witness the assumption of myness and of meanness. Particularly if it's a familiar pain, a familiar tightness in the shoulder or the neck or the knee. And yet there are other times where you can simply witness the arising and ceasing of a sensation without the added perception of me and mine. So this is the difference when we're instructed about seeing the way things are, or we hear this term, seeing the way things are. It's pointing to being able to see things simply in the elements as they are, without the overlays of this is me, this is mine, this is myself. Or we also see those overlays as conditioned mental constructs, or as the process of assuming ownership. Because as we observe that activity in meditation, it acts like a kind of, when you observe a sensation simply just for what it is, and then you observe, it's possible, you don't always see it, but you observe the arising of a sense of self around that, a sense of contraction, a sense of meanness, and it often comes with a sense of either wanting or not wanting it. So when any sensation arises, this is called sense. We call sense contact at the sense door of the body, the tactile sensation. We're aware of that. And in the teaching of dependent origination, what comes after sense contact is feeling tone or vedana. Vedana always comes with sense contact. It doesn't come any other way. So any feeling tone, whether something is experienced as pleasant or painful or neutral, always is arising on sense contact, which is either happening through the body, through sensate experience, or the other senses, through seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, or thinking. Feeling tone arises only and always upon sense contact. So that feeling tone of pleasure or pain is a natural phenomenon, a natural conditioned phenomenon. But the added ingredient is when the mind assumes ownership and adds the assumption, me, mine, or the assumption comes in, this is me, this is mine. Once there's that assumption, this is in the territory of tanha upadana, or craving and clinging. We've imputed a sense of me-ness or I-ness onto this momentary experience. And usually once there's me-ness and I-ness and mindness, if that goes unseen or unquestioned, it leads to a certain reactivity, which is I want or I don't want. Craving, clinging, becoming, it leads us into further proliferation. If it's an experience we don't want, we often engage in proliferation of how to get rid of it, mental proliferation or agitation. If it's a pleasant feeling, sometimes we if the mind moves into ownership or assumption of it, it doesn't just see pleasant feeling for what it is, and it doesn't just enjoy pleasant feeling for what it is. It takes ownership and says, starts to proliferate around it, you know, like, so great, I've really got it now. This is what peace is all about. Yay, how can I keep this going? And so we can start thinking around that rather than simply seeing a pleasant feeling tone arising with, say, a sensation to be felt as pleasant, or even based on a pleasant memory, a pleasant feeling tone arises. And so this sense of self is born from this assuming. And assuming only happens through a lack of seeing the way things are, the lack of just simply seeing these experiences arising and ceasing. They have a certain karmic momentum in that they're arising due to past causes. If there is enough stillness and clarity in the mind just to see these experiences arising and ceasing, then grasping doesn't have to happen. Clinging doesn't have to happen. Identification with those experiences doesn't have to happen. And therefore they just cease and pass. But when they remain unexamined according to Dhamma, when they're not seen in the clarity of just the way they are as a karmic momentum, then this assumption of ownership takes place, and then the ensuing action of present karma, we do something with it, and it's usually wanting or not wanting, wanting to keep, wanting to sustain, wanting to get rid of, and some kind of proliferation around all of that, and all centered around a bit of a self-image and where I'm going with this and what I want and what I don't want. So being able to observe this process more and more, you know, we can still observe when that clinging, when that ego, those ego tendencies come in, there's still the possibility to see all that. And you can notice when there is the seeing of those various conditions at play, it actually interrupts that whole process. So that process of dependent origination can stop and cease and collapse in the moment of seeing things just as they are. So this is the faculty of wisdom in the mind that can see the causal processes in this way. So it's not about trying to overlay an idea, even based on the Dharma, but learning to rest in awareness and to observe. And we learn the theory of dependent origination, of the Four Noble Truths. We learn about observing the characteristics of transience and changeability, how things arise and cease. They appear and disappear. These conditions are never stable. They're always in a process of flux and flow and change and interaction with other conditions. So we learn to recognize those characteristics as they are, not imputing an idea, overlaying an idea and trying to force a certain vision onto our experience, but really trusting in awareness and observing. And as you trust in awareness, what happens is the doer can relax a bit. The egoic doer that really wants to see things the way things are, that really wants to get free of suffering, you know, that really wants to get enlightened, that doer can relax a bit too. Just settle back into awareness and simply observe. Because the karmic momentum continues. And we can, the mind, the wisdom mind, can discern and observe these different experiences. And when attention is drawn in to karmic momentum, if you like. We can see, you know, we're half aware. It's a bit dreamlike, isn't it, in meditation, if attention is drawn into proliferating about what we're going to do tomorrow. And we might spend 10 minutes, you know, with not much mindfulness, just enough mindfulness to kind of have a sense of awareness. But then we wake up and say, oh, I've just been thinking about tomorrow. We see that thinking process. And then it collapses. As soon as we have that mindfulness to see it in an objective way, attention has come out of it. It's been in it and fueling it, I guess. And then something sees it, thought process, and it stops. And so we can contemplate cessation of that thought process. What does it feel like for that thought construct that for a while, 10 minutes, half an hour, or however long one was engaged in, when one notices thought construct, it collapses, it's gone, it's disappeared. And you can see how we get caught into thought constructs as a kind of a pseudo-reality. It's very much like a dream world when we observe that. So that's important just to recognize. And actually, when there's not a lot of mindfulness in our daily life, we can often be caught up in these creations of thought constructs, kind of telling us the way things are, but really it's being dictated to by the karmic tendencies, really, and the push-pull, the wanting, not wanting around pleasure and pain, where we think we're going, who we think we are, what we think we're doing. And of course we need to be able to operate in the conventional world. So some of that narrative is very relevant, but a lot of that narrative is not relevant at all. A lot of the narrative is just reinforcing some old sense of who we think we are. Just like when you notice you maybe have a memory of a painful situation in the past, maybe it's something you regret, and it comes up in your meditation, and you can spend a lot of time reliving that and re-regretting that before you see, memory, thought construct, and stop fueling it, because it's unnecessary to fuel it, because it's just repeating, creating a certain sense, image of oneself and a certain quality of suffering. But when we see it's just a habitual thought construct or simply thinking in that moment, it collapses. And that it's so important to keep recognizing it collapses and there's just this field of awareness. So what's more real, the field of awareness or that thought bubble, that thought construction that may have been sustained for 10 minutes or 30 minutes or even longer through the feeding of attention and mental proliferation? But then when it is seen with wisdom, it is seen for what it is, it collapsed. So you remove the fuel, the fire goes out, and then there is this, the field of awareness is recognized again. The field of awareness is always present. It's just that when attention is completely focused in on thought constructs, it's a very, very peripheral awareness of that field. But when the thought constructs collapse, that field of awareness becomes much more vibrant as the basis of this mind, of this present moment reality. And it's still in itself. It has a quality of silence in itself. It has this quality of knowingness, of spaciousness, of boundlessness as well. You can't find within your own experience any edges to that. You can see edges to thought processes and sensations, the arising and ceasing of feeling tones, of memories, thoughts. You can see edges to that because they appear and disappear. But this field of awareness is something that seems to be ever present, whether we know it in that moment or not. So this is the field of inquiry that is fruitful to inquire into, because right, this is the very territory the Buddha was speaking to in the Buddha's day, we might say certain, I don't know if it's the right term to talk of it as pre-science, but you take your own empirical experience and look into it to understand reality, rather than using other tools, the powerful telescopes we have to look into the outer space, or the powerful microscopes we have to look into inner space. We can understand certain aspects of our existence, our cosmos, through that science. But the Buddha's approach is through empirical reality, which is what is here and now within your own experience. He's saying it's possible to come to realize the fullness of reality, to come to understand the fullness of the conditioned world, but also the unconditioned reality. The unconditioned reality he talked about as being the deathless reality, the undying, the unchanging, the timeless. That this sphere of reality can be experienced individually with wisdom, each person for themselves. And that is the only way full awakening or full enlightenment can happen, is through your own individual experience and recognition of this unconditioned reality, which is ever-present here and now, but just not quite comprehended or seen clearly yet. In order to see it clearly, we have to understand the conditioned reality, that which obfuscates, that which obstructs the vision, is our habitual attachment and clinging and identification with the conditioned reality. The conditioned reality is those things that arise and cease, that move and change, that are karmically driven. Part of the terrain of cause and effect. Both are present, both are in play. But until the wisdom faculty can discern what's what, there's no opportunity to penetrate fully to this unconditioned reality and to know this as the undying truth, the unchanging truth, to no longer find the mind clinging and identifying with things that are changing and conditioned and productive of suffering in that way. So this injunction or reminder to trust in awareness, it reminds us that awareness is ever-present. It's a natural faculty. We don't have to create it. The practice is just learning how to notice it, recognize it, and trust that the Dhamma is unfolding here and now, always within this sphere of awareness, this field of awareness. We're not going to come to see the Dhamma yesterday or in the past. We're not going to come to see the Dhamma in the future either. It's only here and now. And it's not a Dhamma that is not available to us. It is the ordinary Dhamma that is unfolding for each of us in our own body and mind, whether it's sickness, whether it's pain, whether it's unwanted things, it's all dharma to be observed, to be understood, to sharpen the wisdom faculty on, to learn how to rest, to observe, to trust awareness, and just notice the way things are. So much of our suffering as meditators comes about because we want to be better. We want to get rid of the things in the mind that are ugly, that are painful, greed, hatred, delusion. We'd love to get rid of them. We'd love to be free of restlessness. We want to experience peace, joy, happiness. But we're still caught in that push-pull, that preferencing, rather than just being willing to settle and observe things as they are. And notice when the conditioned habit of taking ownership of something that is wanted or unwanted happens. Taking ownership of something that is pleasant or painful happens. When we see that, that's where we can see the first noble truth arising with identification, with I-ness, me-ness, my-ness. But it arises when the mind, the wisdom mind notices it arises, and so does suffering. When you can discern where and how you can let, just rest back into awareness, that identification, that clinging activity also subsides. In the same way as the mental construct collapses when you recognize it for what it is, just the same as when we recognize dukkha as the first noble truth, when we recognize there's clinging to an identity here, when we learn how to rest into awareness, this is where letting go happens. We don't have to push anything away, make anything look different, but recognize dukkha, it's arising, and with the relaxing around it, or the letting go of the clinging, not the pushing away, the clinging, not the berating oneself for clinging, not the wishing this pain wasn't here, but just things as they are. Now this feels painful. I can see the resistance. This is what resistance feels like. This is what anger feels like. This is what discomfort feels like. This is what restlessness feels like. This is what longing feels like. This is what confusion feels like. It feels like this. It's a mind state. Can I breathe with it? And just keep watching and see it start to dissolve, because it can't stay the same. Ironically, when we keep fueling these experiences with assuming them to be me and mine, with the wanting and the not wanting, that's feeding the fire, it's keeping the fire going. And that's what ignorance is. We don't actually see that that's keeping the suffering going. We haven't figured out yet what the cause of suffering is and what the cessation of suffering, the cause of the cessation of suffering is. How that can come about. The more we learn to trust in awareness, settle back into awareness, and just notice things as they are, even if they're not the way we want them to be. It's like this. Let that awareness reflect things just as they are, and notice that the clinging starts to drop away. Just because your attention has come out of a focus on the object, a push-pull relationship, to trusting in awareness. The ever-present knowing as the refuge in Buddha. Buddha knowing the Dhamma. Buddha knowing things just as they are. And more that just as they are becomes clearer the more you learn to rest in awareness. Things as they are, you start to see them more clearly. there's less tendency to get involved and mess it all up, kick up more dust, which makes it harder to see things as they are, even though recognizing that dust kicking is also seeing things as they are. That's also the Dharma of confusion, of dukkha, of, you know, sensation, feeling, perception. It's all there. So in a sense, nothing is wrong. Everything is Dharma. We can learn from everything. Everything is included. Even when we feel we don't have any perspective and I'm thoroughly caught in a storm or confusion, you can be aware of that. Aware of that notion, aware of that thought, aware of the feeling tones, aware of the sensations associated with that. Aware of awareness itself. Remembering, ah yes, I can trust this. I don't have to do anything to fix anything. Just rest in awareness. So in a way, it's simple. It's our habit patterns that complicate things or appear to complicate things. So the Dhamma can help to remind us of the simplicity. And of course, you learn from your own experience as you practice in this way, and learn your trust, your faith will deepen and wisdom will grow. Doesn't mean you encounter less challenges necessarily, but maybe every new challenge is another great opportunity for deepening that wisdom. And many of us shy away from challenges quite naturally. Even the Buddha said quite naturally, what we fear is pain. Yeah, so there is that natural inclination to pull away from pain. But the more we're able to recognize, as I said earlier, just painful feeling always arises on sense contact, and sense contact is always momentary. It's always very momentary. It's like that. If we see that much, then the feelings can also just drop away like that, along with the identification and the concretization of that, the solidification of conceiving myself, my world, in one way only. So this is one way of articulating the path, and I hope that something of what I've said has been helpful for you tonight.